All right, boom, we're live. Welcome to Talk Mental Health with Dr. Logan Noon. This is like 6 years in the making, Sarah.
Yeah, I know. I'm so sorry.
No, you've been busy. You know, you are now a mother of two. I'm just super stoked to have you on here. I've known you since, I guess, I met your husband, first mm-hmm. year of medical school at PNWU. You know, I always joke with like my friends in anesthesia, like me, as a psychiatrist and an anesthesiologist, probably have one thing in common is that we'll both be slinging ketamine in some means or another for different mm-hmm. different reasons, of course. But he's talked about you, of course, very highly, of course, for very many years about how you're a therapist. So Dr. Sarah Morant holds a PhD in counseling and MA in marriage and family therapy. I know you hold the license in Maine, Minnesota, and Washington. So, hey, look, if any of you listeners enjoy our conversation today, I definitely encourage you to check out balancepointcounseling.com and check out Sarah's potential services and see if she's a good fit for you. I know one thing that you really like helping people with is post-traumatic stress disorder. So I think we should kind of start our conversation there. What do you think?
Yeah, what a wide topic to begin with.
Right. And I think, you know, it seems so much easier to talk about even in 2013 when we're talking now compared to, you know, 2017 when me and you met each other. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, are you finding that clients they're finding it easier to open up about perhaps their past trauma? Is there maybe less stigma, that word, compared to previously? What has been your experience?
Well, it's kind of interesting because I'm on the young side as a provider, so I'm still on the early end of my career, I think. So it's a little hard to totally gauge that question in terms of like what's the movement from when I started practicing till now. I do think in general, we're seeing more and more of just open conversations about mental health. So coming in, period, feels easier. But talking about trauma is a sticky one because sometimes avoidance is actually the best coping mechanism to get through day to day. And so even in the safety and vulnerable space of being with a therapist, avoidance is still like what we've learned. So it can be really hard to undo that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I sent you kind of questions and like, mm-hmm. I feel like sort of capable of treating PTSD, right? Like, so I'm, if this is your first time listening to this podcast, I took the more medical side of treating mental health, right? Like trying to provide medications. I went to medical school and Sarah took the kind of therapy route. And I'm not going to lie, Sarah, there's many days where I almost wish I took your route. You know, I contemplated both roles and I do want to build a practice that allows me to, you know, provide talk therapy. But just the way our healthcare system is, I do feel somewhat handicapped. So I'll get off my soapbox for a second. But I guess where I wanted to go with this first part is like, how do you kind of define trauma before we even get to the, you know, what the DSM and the exact criteria for PTSD, like what is trauma to you? What is trauma to your clients?
Yeah, it's a really good basic question. And I think, to be honest, the answer for most clinicians is a little different than what we're seeing in the DSM right now, just partly out of experience, what we're actually seeing in front of us. But also, there's so much more understanding now in terms of the neurobiology of trauma and just knowing what's going on at that neurological level. So trauma, at least the way that I define it and how I talk about it with my own patients, is essentially any memories, anything that has happened in our past that we really haven't healed from adaptively. So yes, that could be major traumas like something that's life-threatening or witnessing the death of somebody else, absolutely. But frankly, it could also be something like a painful moment in childhood or being mistreated by a parent or a teacher or a confusing moment with friends as a kid during a really developmentally charged period of life. So trauma can look like a lot of different things. And really, it's less about the intensity of the event itself. And it's much more about kind of how that event is stored in our brains and how it might be accessed as we continue to live our day-to-day life now.
Yeah. And I totally agree with you there. You broke up on me for a second, but I was kind of, what I heard, at least the pieces of it's, you know, not healing, not responding in a healthy way from some event in your life, whatever that event may exactly be. And, you know, I got a sense in our email exchange that you have a similar frustration to me, because the DSM kind of defines PTSD criteria A, which is required. A person has exposure to a death, threatened death, actual or threatened serious injury, or actual or threatened sexual violence in the following ways: direct exposure, witnessing the event, learning about a close relative or friend that was exposed to this trauma, or indirectly exposure to adverse details of the trauma, usually in the course of professional duties like first responders, medics, perhaps police officers. And like, I agree with that. Oh, sorry, I'm getting a call here. Let me decline this. I agree with that. You know, of course, that can result in PTSD, but I think, like, you know, our brains are going to respond in neurochemical pathways, regardless of if they're exposed to a traumatic event like this, or like a death exposure like this, or sexual violence exposure like this. You know, is that person who gets bullied really severely at school going to have a same neurochemical response in the brain? And, you know, kind of what got this conversation going really charged in my mind, I went to the American Psychiatric Association components meeting 2 weeks ago in Baltimore. It was awesome. I'm really enjoying my advocacy efforts there, but I was hanging out with this psychiatry resident who's with the armed services. So he's treating veterans all the time, right? So his specialty is PTSD in a sense, or it's something he sees, of course, so frequently. So he was telling this story of a Navy SEAL who was attempting to become a Navy SEAL, was going through BUDS training, and BUDS training, of course, requires like all these significant tests and swimming challenges and all these things. And he, in his words, almost drowned. And he was having like these recurrent nightmares, and like also shame that like he rung the bell and needed help in this activity and got out of the water. And how he kind of self-diagnosed himself with PTSD before going and seeing one of my colleagues here, and how my colleague and his attending psychiatrist, which is like a supervising psychiatrist, were talking about how, look, like if we look at the DSM criteria for PTSD, like, you know, this individual didn't wake up in a hospital intubated or something. Like he didn't necessarily almost die. Like he was able to swim over and ring the bell. Does he truly meet criteria for PTSD? Or is this maybe like an adjustment disorder with like anxious mood or depressed mood, whatever? And like, I get so frustrated with psychiatry and psychology, because it's like, why does this matter? You know, like this person's suffering, whether they almost died or like, it's like, you know, the, like I said before, the neurochemical pathways in the brain are analogous.
Right.
All right. If you like Talk Mental Health with Dr. Logan Noon, I guarantee you will like my other podcast, The Psych Guys, where I'm alongside with my colleague, Dr. Jun Chung. What do we talk about on The Psych Guys?
We produce educational content regarding everything mental health related. So come check us out.
Right. Well, and I think what you're touching on too is actually a broader issue, not just with the diagnosis of PTSD, but with diagnosis period, right? The reality is most people don't fit neatly into boxes, and I think on your end of things, you kind of have to fit them in a certain way. And we certainly do too, as therapists. We're billing insurance as well. We've got to have a diagnosis at the top of the sheet. But at the same time, we can be a little more flexible in how we're treating our patients. We can kind of look at them as a few different diagnoses at once. We can be a bit more flexible there, I think.
So I'm curious, you know, someone who's listening, I imagine we have listeners out there who perhaps have never seen a therapist or a psychiatrist before, maybe have had bad experiences with six of those people. And, you know, look, they're not getting the care they need. They perhaps haven't received a diagnosis that makes sense to them or that they agree with. What kind of symptoms, experiences would a person in your eyes experience if they are truly suffering from PTSD?
Such a tricky question, right? Because PTSD has such a hugely varied presentation. And so we can go through the DSM and we can check off, you know, are we seeing hypervigilance? Are we seeing you know, arousal symptoms, all these pieces. But the reality is the picture of PTSD in patient A versus patient B can look wildly different. And I think it's kind of a sneaky diagnosis where it's not that uncommon for PTSD to stem from experiences that don't fit the big T trauma definitions. And so there may be many people out there who are probably fitting criteria or meeting criteria for PTSD who would never actually have thought of it themselves. And so, yeah, some of it might be going through DSM and taking a look at some of those symptoms and seeing, do I check some of these boxes? But the biggest thing that I really think most people tend to see in terms of how PTSD symptoms show up for them day to day is how they relate to other people. PTSD really, really impacts our interpersonal relationships and the way that we relate to other people, and really kind of the way we attach to the other people within our lives. So people who are really struggling to connect or struggling to have healthy connections with other humans in their lives, it's possible trauma may be at the root of things.
Very interesting. Yeah. And honestly, I'm surprised. You know, I actually thought what you would have said is I would have actually maybe not necessarily like interpersonal challenges, but I like to use like negative self-coping strategies, right? Mm-hmm. Like the fancy term of coping in or doing something to self-medicate, right? Maybe that's with a drug, but a lot of times it seems like also, you know, cutting, right? Or other self-harmful behavior, perhaps that's binge eating or something like that.
But I think this is what I mean by it's such a wide presentation. Mm-hmm. There are many patients who are going to come up with maladaptive coping strategies. And there are also trauma patients who have perfectly adaptive coping strategies. And it's coming out in other really more insidious ways that are a lot less easy to pick up on. That's why I do think the interpersonal piece sometimes is like that sneaky presentation that we don't always necessarily pick up on trauma, but that is so, so commonly where these symptoms actually come out.
Right. Interesting. Yeah. Because like, you know, in my mind, when I hear interpersonal issues, whatever, immediately my mind goes to,
you're going personality disorders.
Yes, you took the words out of my mouth.
Which I wanted to talk about a little bit too. I think frankly there's a huge overlap between personality disorders and PTSD, and frankly there are plenty of therapists out there who actually kind of view personality disorders, many of them, as actually being much more effectively conceptualized as PTSD. And particularly when we're talking about borderline personality disorders, so many of the different symptoms that we see within those kinds of personality disorders line up quite a bit with what we also see in trauma. And it's again, that maladaptive, you know, conjuring up of our memories, maladaptive ways of functioning, and it all comes out in the ways that we interact with other people in our lives.
Interesting. Interesting. You know, I have this theory, and I'm sure you would agree with it, right? I like to think of like the world of health. I'm biased because I work in mental health, but I think of so many health conditions as secondary to mental health issues. You know, perhaps someone's depressed or very anxious and their negative self-coping strategy is overeating. Therefore, we lead to obesity, right? And like how many issues are perhaps related to that? Hypertension, diabetes, stroke. We could go on and on. But then even extrapolating that further, perhaps mental illness is really secondary from trauma, right? Like we are so aware of these adverse childhood events. So, you know, a lot of times, like I think about like where you're bringing up borderline personality disorder, perhaps it is actually a result of PTSD. You know, I don't have the facts in front of me, but I know a vast majority of these individuals who live with borderline personality disorder also have a comorbid trauma, maybe that they experience, comorbid substance abuse issues, you know, you name it. And, you know, one of the first questions I sent you is like, what's one thing psychiatrists and maybe psychologists like aren't doing the most effectively or helping in the best way?
Yeah.
And I think psychiatrists are truly failing individuals with personality disorders.
Yeah.
I feel
like
a lot of times we kind of wash our hands. Hey, look, we don't have any good medicines. Good luck, therapists.
Well, and the go-to is like, go find someone who does DBT, right?
Right.
We know that that's the only proven therapy out there for these individuals. And look, DBT is fantastic. I love using DBT. CBT, and it is so impactful for clients who it really fits with. And I really think there's a huge subsection of people who maybe fit criteria for a borderline personality disorder where the trauma actually kind of supersedes any of the personality pieces. And the trauma really gets in the way of being able to engage in the DBT learning, right? They can learn the skills, they can kind of grasp why they're helpful, but they're really failing to put them into place because the underlying trauma and the reactions to those trauma memories are really getting in the way of actually implementing particularly distress tolerance skills. So I think really where we're failing people is this, like, let's stick with cognitive therapies. Let's go directly to DBT because it's where, you know, most of the evidence is for this population, and not having that nuance to say borderline personality maybe means trauma. Maybe we need to look at trauma first.
Very interesting. So yeah, one of the things that we were kind of chatting about briefly is, like, in your opinion, how do you think we're failing the PTSD population? How do you think we're getting this wrong?
I mean, it's a tough question, right? I would like to think that in general, on a personal level, everyone out there, every provider is really doing their best. And I think really as a whole, where there's maybe the biggest mistake is just underdiagnosis of trauma, because trauma feels complicated. And there are therapists out there who say, I don't do trauma. And wow. To me, that's kind of a crazy statement, because frankly,
I don't do depression.
Right. Yeah. And honestly, everything's trauma, right? Technically, if you really bring it down to just maladaptive memories, everything kind of is trauma. And so to me, to write off that population altogether is ludicrous.
Yeah. Yeah, I would argue malpractice even, you know, it's, you know, right. Cause it's like trauma is such a nebulous word, and we can try to define trauma, you know, with these criteria, like we were talking about earlier, but like, if you're going through re-experiencing something that was so negative in your life, isn't that in a sense trauma? Like, I always like to say the analogy, like, okay, yes, I did not get drafted for war, and I did not have to go to Vietnam like, you know, some of my the generations in front of me did. And I can't even imagine how extreme and negative that experience must have been. But I also didn't experience that. I can think of like what was the most painful and worst experience in my life. Mm-hmm. And I actually talk about how my manic episode, pieces of it were traumatic, right? And I didn't almost die. I didn't almost, but I was in a mental health wing of a hospital in a locked facility. And I hated that feeling of being locked so much that, like, that to me, I interpreted that and I internalized that as trauma. And I remember that feeling of being there. And there's even at times, as much as I do this podcast, I talk publicly, I even still get emotional talking about that experience. Like, why is that not trauma, right? And I know you would agree with me, but
yeah, well, two pieces stand out why this probably qualifies, right? First of all, if it feels traumatic, end of discussion, it was traumatic for you, right? But the other piece here too is you're talking about a moment when you really experienced a loss of control, a loss of power and autonomy. You were in a locked room. It wasn't up to you what was going to happen next. And that in itself is really highly traumatizing to just our sense of autonomy. The other piece that I think potentially contributes to a moment like that ending up being stored as a trauma for you is potentially what happened next. Did you receive validation for this trauma? Did you receive support and empathy from those around you that, yes, this was in fact traumatizing and the way you felt made a whole lot of sense? Or did you get a lot of that, well, that's not really a trauma. This is just what happens when you're in the middle of a manic episode. And so let's move on with our lives, right? Had you been received with nothing but empathy and warmth, you might have been able to make some more meaning of that memory. But if you had even a little bit of invalidation, that could be enough to really kind of store this in your mind a bit more maladaptively.
That's a very interesting philosophical question. You know, it's almost, I sometimes think about like, what if I had a manic episode in 2023, like this year, versus when it happened. And that was 2011, you know, even though it's only been 12 years, it's like the world of stigma is different. And of course, my persona is different now. Like, everybody knows I have bipolar disorder, everybody, but whatever. You get what I'm saying? You know, if I were to have a manic episode now, I actually would feel comfortable disclosing that. And I wonder if the experience of going to a psych ward again, and geez, I hope it doesn't happen. But I think I would get support from outside of people just in my family, right? Versus mm-hmm. in 2011, the experience of having a manic episode was so shameful. I didn't want to tell anybody. I didn't get cards from any of my friends or family while I was in the mm-hmm. hospital. But I don't blame them. I didn't tell them. It wasn't something I was proud of, you know? So it's definitely changed throughout time.
So if you really want to look at it even deeper, you could probably take a look at, you know, the way that you've used your own mental health as a platform and a way to open up conversations and normalize conversations. Frankly, even the existence of this podcast perhaps is driven a little bit out of this desire to keep normalizing your experience, to keep finding ways to put it out there, and maybe instead of sitting in shame around it, sit in a place of validation for yourself, but even from everybody else you get to talk to.
Right. You know, or I like to just make jokes about how perhaps my experience as a human is like the typical stereotype of a psychiatrist. Like they went in that field because they must have a little something going on and they're trying to figure it out. It's like, yeah, no, that's actually exactly what it kind of is in many ways.
Yeah, because they're a human living a human experience just like all the rest of us.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's see what other questions I kind of wanted to grill you with here. Okay, so while we're on the topic of PTSD, you know, look, I think we can both agree one bullshit aspect of mental health treatment these days is simple wait times, right? You know, mm-hmm. It's just really, really hard. So let's imagine someone's listening right now. Perhaps they can't get in to see a psychiatrist or a therapist for quite some time, or maybe mm-hmm. there's financial things going on. How would you advise that listener on how to perhaps improve their symptoms of irritability, flashbacks, nightmares, hypervigilance, being, you know, afraid to go in crowds or whatever from perhaps some trauma that they experienced? How would you want to help that person?
I think I would probably direct, I mean, aside from keep looking for a therapist, keep at it. It's worth looking. It's worth finding that right fit for you. The other pieces I would suggest are some simple psychoeducation. Frankly, trauma is one of those rare mental disorders where learning more about it can in itself undo some of your symptoms. Just simply understanding why I'm reacting the way I am to an experience I've had can really offer some validation in itself, right? I'm not just going crazy. I'm not just having this crazy experience no one else has had. My body is reacting in the way that it's supposed to react to something like this. That in itself is so validating that sometimes it can actually create quite a shift in itself. The other piece I would recommend is some level of intentional, mindful reprocessing. You know, a lot of therapy and especially cognitive therapies are really based on this principle that if we talk about the trauma, if we process through the details of the memory in as much detail as possible, we essentially rewire the structure of that memory. We essentially move it away from that hot trauma memory to a much more processed kind of cold memory. And so you can do a little bit of that yourself just by either talking about it, or what I would even recommend is journaling about it. Write down the details you remember and go back through and reread it and write it down again. The more you replay those details, the more you talk about it with somebody else, the less powerful, the less kind of hot that memory becomes for you. That being said, if it's a really, really painful memory, if it's painful to even imagine talking about it, it's probably better to wait until you're kind of in the managed care of a therapist who can walk you through it and give you some other coping skills, because going back through and reprocessing in itself can bring up a whole lot.
Yeah. You could say that again, right? Absolutely. Yeah, and I guess I agree with everything that you were saying right there. And one thing that I feel so many, and outside of just journaling, so many people could be doing on their own, but they choose not to, is the practice of trying to build meditation. And I like to make an analogy just between exercise and meditation. Like, you know, just because you're not the most perfect person exercising, that doesn't mean you shouldn't do it. Yet I get that response when, oh, I can't meditate because I can't clear my mind. It's like, well, that's not actually what we're trying to do here. It's simply the act, the pursuit. Yeah. And knowing that it's an impossible goal. You know, you're not going to become this enlightened Buddha that can think about nothing for 4 hours at a time. Mm-hmm. Are there particular, like when you were saying self-education, one thing that I kind of laughed to in my mind and I got a little scared of, it's like, uh-oh, like TikTok. You know? Mm-hmm. Like, it seems like I try to advertise on TikTok, whatever. But like, are there particular bloggers, TikTokers, YouTubers that you advise your clients that this is a good resource or good web pages, this is a good resource?
That's a really good question too, because I actually do. And I think, although we can probably definitely talk about the problems of social media and mental health, and frankly, just even the way that mental health is talked about on social media, what it is absolutely doing is helping this normalization. I mean, it's all over TikTok, it's all over Instagram. You know, people are familiar with terminology. I'm having clients come in and like tell me all about their personality disorder that they have already self-diagnosed, mm-hmm. for better or for worse, right? There's some pieces of that are challenging. But yeah, one resource that I really like, and I'm going to just make sure I'm going to get the right handle here. So I do quite a bit of focus on attachment theory, and there is an Instagram page, and I think she probably has a TikTok handle as well. Yes, by Julie Manano, and her handle is The Secure Relationship. And it's a great follow for anybody who's feeling like attachment patterns are impacting how they show up in relationships. Just offers some really clear, concise diagrams and explanations for kind of how our attachment patterns impact the way we're showing up with other people.
Okay, awesome. So, you know, we're still kind of, I guess, on like PTSD. So I want to bring this up. You know, a lot of new news, right, is this, seems like there's been such a cultural shift in the attitude towards psychedelics and psychedelics aspect in medicine. I get so excited about this because I listened to this one podcast because I felt like, and their analogy was like, okay, we approach at least psychiatry so much like biomedical, right? And even if we do choose to give this medicine, you know, whatever, psilocybin, DMT, whatever it may be, it's bringing like the psych, the psychology, perhaps back into psychiatry. What do you think psychedelics could potentially do for better or for worse in the world of therapy and your practice? What do you think?
I mean, it's not a part of my practice right now. It's not anything I would ever tell a patient that I have any specialty in. So honestly, if a patient came to me with a question like this, I would probably look for some referrals. And there are some incredible therapists out there who are starting to kind of find ways to blend psychedelics work with the therapy work they're doing themselves. And I think it's a cool other option for patients out there for sure. I don't think it's going to shape my practice necessarily. But I think there are going to be a lot of other clinicians out there where it does.
Yeah. I mean, I'm very excited about it. You know, I agree with you. It's certainly not fully understood yet. And of course, it's not FDA approved. Looks like MDMA may be kind of the next thing to kind of treat PTSD in this field. And I get so excited, like, okay, is it... Is the use of purely MDMA effective? Is it use of MDMA, but in the setting of a trained therapist who's able to walk a person through that experience? Is perhaps music and chants going to be as effective as that therapy session? Because what I'm of course sort of afraid of is that if the legality gets ahead of the medicine, which it seems like it's fucking going to happen, where what I mean by that is these things are going to start to become legalized throughout the country. And then you can go to any shaman or whatever on the side of the street who has no official training that I know of. And look, I don't think I should be so overly biased in thinking that that person is going to be ineffective either. That only a psychiatrist,
perfectly well-trained shaman, you never know.
Right. Only a psychiatrist or only a therapist can handle this kind of thing. Like, I think a lot about how, like, okay, could a religious person be an effective use of this medicine or drug, whatever you want to say. But I get excited about it. I get nervous about it. either way, it's going to shake up both of our lives, I think, radically throughout our career.
Well, and most importantly, it's yet another option for treatment. You know, there are patients who would like to go into a psychiatrist and get a prescription and just deal with their issues as much as they can that way. There are patients who never want to see a doctor and are much more comfortable seeing a therapist. And there are patients who don't want to see either of us, but if they right. can go down the street and pick up some drugs from somebody else that might help them a little better, they're going to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely, I think I agree with you. We have to have like a wide array of treatment options and approaches. You know, I get really frustrated with, okay, our treatment to PTSD, to depression, to anxiety is SSRI and therapy. It's like, okay, but it's not a mm-hmm. one size fit all kind of right. approach.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think artificial intelligence is going to impact your job?
That's such an interesting question. I saw an article, it's been a bit now, but maybe a year or so ago, that was listing kind of the jobs that are going to be most impacted. And therapist is right down at the bottom, one of the least likely to be impacted by artificial intelligence. It makes a lot of sense. I think even when we look at really standardized therapies like EMDR or CPT, something where there's almost a script to be following, what we see over and over and again is when we do research on it, it's something about that human presence, something about somebody just listening to you that is a really pivotal part of healing. And, you know, you can have a computer go through and read the right scripts and you think about all the right things, but if you aren't feeling that warmth of another human sitting with you in that kind of unconditional validation, we just don't see the same level of healing. So it's hard for me to see how AI is going to dramatically change what therapy itself looks like. Hopefully it changes what it looks like for us to take notes. That would be great.
Right. Right. You know, I think it definitely still can impact therapy. You know, I agree with you. I'm very happy to hear that one article had therapy at the bottom of the list. It makes me feel better about my own job security. Because I actually think in the world of medicines, like, could AI just as effectively as me answer the simple question, is this a safe medication regimen alongside all their other medical conditions? I don't know. I mean, it got a very high score on the USMLE, the main board exam that I have to take in medical school. So it's like, maybe yes. So perhaps I always think about how AI actually might push psychiatrists back more into the therapy realm, which once again, I get very excited about. But, mm-hmm. you know, I do think perhaps AI, what if AI could teach effectively the core tenets of CBT for insomnia, for DBT, for perhaps their borderline tendencies? And then I, of course, would never want it to fully eliminate that human connection component. But it's like, yeah. Oh, hey, I spent 5 hours with that chatbot this past week. Can we talk about some of the things I learned? Like, I do totally. Think that could be a really effective means of teaching clients, because I'm sure you have had this experience. Like, hey, I would like you to do this homework. I would like you to read this article, check out this book, check out this podcast. And they're like, yeah. I not many of my patients actually follow through. I don't know about you.
I mean, it really depends a lot. I certainly have my patients who show up with their folder of homework and they're ready to get their gold stars. But it's true. Yeah, follow through is a big piece of this. And I could see AI being so helpful for just kind of carrying therapy and what we're talking about in therapy throughout the week. Right. I can't meet with my patients all day, every day long, but maybe they've got an app where they can check in and have accountability. And I already have some versions of that with some of my clients. Or maybe they have something that they can check in with their DBT skills and put in, like, here's the problem I'm having right now. What's the skill I should use? There are all kinds of ways I can see AI helping us. But at the end of the day, I still think there's something about that human to human connection that is so, so healing and a really pivotal part of this profession.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I agree with you wholeheartedly, you know, and I feel like a lot of treating health has moved away from that human connection, sadly, right? It's something that I want to fight against, of course, throughout my entire career, and I'm sure you do too. So, mm-hmm. you know, I have you about 15 minutes more, or so let's call it. So, you know, I really want you to speak freely on this question and don't feel like you're going to hurt my feelings, because I want to improve this. And what I'm getting at here is, you know, I know that I don't feel actually there's animosity towards psychiatrists, towards therapists. You know, I feel like psychiatrists are very, I hope, very thankful for therapists. I do feel like there is sometimes like now this weird turf war coming because some psychologists want to start prescribing. I have mixed feelings about that. We can talk about that as well. But I want to hear about some complaints you have or maybe that you've heard from your profession about psychiatrists or the psychiatric approach to mental illness. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to badmouth your profession. And I think in general, I think in general, there aren't a lot of hard feelings. I think you're right that there's pretty good coordination, cooperation, and respect on both sides. And frankly, we need more communication. I think there's a little bit of siloing of we've got psychiatrists over here and medication providers doing their thing, and we've got therapists doing their thing over here. And you know, there are practices where people are working a little bit more hand in hand. And I've worked at an agency setting where we got to really meet with our medication providers on a regular basis, and it felt really collaborative. But as soon as you go off into private practice, as I am right now, I really feel very disconnected from providers in the community. And some of that might just be the nature of where I'm practicing right now. But I think in general, we could use a lot more communication. I think mostly what I'm seeing is potential problems in terms of maybe how medications are being handled or how we're having collaboration between medication management and therapy at the same time is, in general, a little bit of communication could really improve what would happen in the therapy experience. And when I think about trauma therapy in particular, I think about those moments when exposure is a critical part of what's being done. Sometimes medication can actually really stand in the way of doing that. You know, if we've got patients who are taking really a high dose of medication, or especially if we're seeing patients on like benzos and they're just not connecting with their emotions, that can just absolutely derail the ability of exposure, you know, for any of our PTSD issues to be at all effective.
Right, right. Yeah, you know, I definitely agree with you. Agree with you there. You know, one thing that I almost wish it was like mandated or like standard of care was a psychiatrist and a psychologist or have to work collaboratively. Like maybe, and I don't, I hope that I can own my own solo practice one day, but what if like in the law of the land is like I had to build in therapy hours. Like I couldn't just see people for 15-minute med management, and perhaps the way of getting there would be hiring and working along a side of a team of the trained therapist, right? That's what I hope, because yeah, I agree with you so much. And you know, maybe one of the simple solutions to improving upon that communication is like an effective software. Like I have a hard time communicating with the psychiatrist that of my clients who maybe they see in the outpatient setting, I see them in the hospital. I never get to talk to their therapist. It's really, really unfortunate. What if, you know, we could share an EMR and communicate that way? You know, it's like we can talk on TikTok and Instagram in 2 seconds, but we can't effectively do this. It's,
I mean, you're describing the dream, right? If you could kind of collaboratively go through treatment together. And I, like I said, I've been in another agency where collaboration looked a little closer to that. And I could even weigh in with medication providers and say like, hey, this is what I'm doing with this patient right now. And let's make sure that medication is, you know, helping to support that. But it's not the norm. It just isn't. And that's really unfortunate because it really should be.
Right. Right. You know, one, I think fair criticism also of the world of therapy, well, it's, you know, there's not enough of you. There's not enough therapists. There's not enough psychiatrists. And we both have different skill sets, shared skill sets in some regard, but different skill sets in another. And, you know, I like to think a lot about the economics surrounding all of healthcare and mental illness. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just spent some time at the VA, which is like sort of socialized medicine, right? I'm not sure how this works in Europe, but like over there, they had, you know, if you have anxiety, you get access to a 10 session class for CBT skills for anxiety. If you need more, tough shit. And then I feel like on the other side of the scale, this, you know, capitalism approach to therapy is, you know, there are some therapists that are completely booked out because they have like standing appointments every Tuesday at 1 o'clock with Miss Nancy or whatever. Yep. And so I feel like that's almost an abuse of resources, like kind of like, okay, well, that's easy money. I'm just seeing this person every week. You know, maybe they're a person really suffering. I'm not saying that they're not, but there are also people who call all these clinics and can't get in at all. And I wish that there was some quality of care like that could optimize that in a better, more effective way. What do you think?
I mean, I think where you're getting at is we're going to start talking about insurance and all the ways that insurance impacts this field too. And, you know, what we're seeing in the field of therapy is that insurance is really, really messy, really, really complicated in terms of what gets reimbursed. And across the board, so many patients don't get reimbursement for therapy sessions or don't get enough reimbursement, but now more and more people are turning to out-of-pocket services and out-of-network providers. And so more and more therapists are simply not even going through insurance channels. I myself am completely out of network right now because the demand is high enough. Mm-hmm. And so again, yeah, it contributes to this just dearth of availability. And you get agencies where the wait list is 4 months to get in, and then you have private practice individuals who have a completely full caseload and aren't even taking insurance. And yeah, it's a really, really messy system right now.
Yeah. And, you know, psychiatrists, a lot of them are guilty of that too. And look, I can't blame them too, where they've kind of moved away from the insurance approach because, you know, of course, not taking insurance and going to a cash model just provides so much incredible flexibility, right? You can do whatever you truly want. And that sounds so incredible. So, yeah, I mean,
Even if we're talking about like what benefits the patient most, I think there's big arguments, right? You're more accessible if you're in network, but at the same time, you're beholden to the insurance companies and you can't necessarily diagnose or practice with exactly what feels like the best fit for the patient. Whereas if you're kind of going out of pocket, you can really do what you think is right for that patient.
Right. Absolutely. Well, I have taken up, you know, I don't know, 40 minutes of your time. More than enough. Thank you again for coming on the show. So if you have enjoyed Sarah, once again, Dr. Sarah Durant, I want you to check out Balance Point Counseling. She takes clients in Maine, Washington, and Minnesota. And so my last question for you, I read that blog you did about developing goals for going to therapy and how that's such a pivotal thing. And like, I didn't, I guess, really think of that. I always just refer my clients to therapy, like, hey, you should find a therapist. This medicine's great, but you really need to find a therapist. But perhaps I'm doing a disservice. Perhaps I need to educate my patients like, okay, you need to find a therapist. But in the meantime, while you're waiting however long, I want you to work on developing these specific goals of whatever. How would you outline how someone, hopefully they like our conversation, hopefully they tune into Balance. What is it again?
Balance Point Counseling.
Balance Point Counseling. Yep. How many times could I say that? Hopefully they tune into this website. How would you advise them on developing goals for your first session?
Yeah. I mean, I think developing goals serves a lot of purposes, right? For the patient, developing goals can actually just give you a little bit of a sense of hope. Like if I can write it down, maybe I can do something with it. It also gives you the chance to check in and see, am I getting what I want out of therapy? Am I actually working towards these goals in a measurable way? I think often we think about therapy as this nebulous, like, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just talking about my problems. Why am I here? But really, actually, we want to see change. We want to see something measurable. So I love when patients can start out right away and say, this is why I'm here. Here's what I want to see. For me as a provider, those goals are really helpful too, because it just gives me really clear understanding of what are we working on, where do we want to start. And, you know, we might get derailed or we might notice there are other goals along the way, but I can hopefully keep us focused on those things that brought you in the first place. As far as how to find those goals, it's such a personal process that I think doing some reflection on day to day, what's coming up for me that's getting in the way of just living my life the way I want to. So is it symptoms that are coming up that keep me from socializing the way I want to? Is there something that's happening that makes it hard to function at work? You know, whatever that specific symptom is, being as specific as possible and really thinking about what would it look like if that felt different? What would it look like if therapy had been effective and I could look back and say, oh yeah, that worked. That's a really, really helpful place to start.
Right. You know, I like the way you phrase that. You know, I've I've asked this to many of my patients before. Like, what is your goal? Like, what do you, in my respect, of course, I'm trying to do some therapy, but it's like, what do you hope that a medicine could do for you? You know, what is the goal of this treatment? And patients struggle with that. And so how I've tried to frame it, it's like, what does your ideal life look like?
Yeah.
Describe it to me. Where are you living? Are you in a relationship? Like cars, so I talk cars a little bit. But it's like, and I'm not saying our goal should be to get you in a Ferrari, but it's like, okay, how can we, maybe it's getting you a more stable career. Maybe it's getting you out of your comfort zone to start engaging romantically, right? Mm-hmm. And what ways can we effectively work towards that? And then getting more into the nitty gritty, it's like, well, what's holding you back from that romantic experience? Is it your anxiety, your self-doubt? And then like targeting what we can really do there. So I've really enjoyed this conversation. I have taken up 45 minutes of your time. I'm getting you out on time to get back to your, two kids.
Wonderful.
Cause what, you have a 2-year-old and a, you said like 3-month-old? No.
We're even ahead of that now. We've got a 3-year-old and a 9-month-old.
Oh, okay. Very cool. Very cool. Well, I will, you know, link your pages and thanks again for coming on. This was super, super cool. Any last words for the internet audience here?
I don't think so, but this was so much fun. Thank you, Logan.
All right, cool.